Welcome to this first ever Leslie Riddick podcast extras event, which is the first of our special podcasts that are being recorded for pals and buddies. These are the brackets of folk who have been good enough to make a wee contribution to the upkeep of the podcast, shall we say. And it's an incredible coincidence, and it really is, that the very first one that we're able to do is actually about a subject which for me is the reason I got involved in politics. It's just run like a thread through my entire life. No, not the Nordics, but they kind of come into it. Land reform. Now, I can feel quite a lot of people who know me for my entire life going, God, no, not an entire one of land reform. But the great thing about this is it's not me bleating on. Oh, no, it is new folk coming into this debate. Glory be. And we have today the author, well, one of the co-authors of a report that's, I think and I hope, going to make a massive impact on this debate in Scotland, Duncan McCann. Duncan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Leslie.
And gosh, that's awfully polite. Let's get Pat in to just sort of lower the tone.
Oh, I'm here. And as I said before we started, I care as much about this as flying the air, so I'll be hudding my weesh and chipping in with daft questions. I hope that helps. So I'm here.
That's good. Brilliant. Now, Duncan, when we were talking beforehand, you were getting awfully apologetic about the fact you've got a mere Scottish name than Pat, but you signed off a posh. So just to kind of like unravel that, where are you from?
Well, that's a question I ask myself a lot. my dad was from Stirlingshire, so just outside Stirling in Alloa. So I have a deep connection with Alloa, Stirling and that area. But just before I was born, my parents moved to Brussels to join the whole EU institutions. And he became a lifelong civil servant for the EU. And I grew up happily in Brussels until becoming a grown up and then coming over to study in London. And now I live here with my family and my partner and my three kids. And so London is now my home. But my partner's also half Scottish, and so Scotland is kind of definitely our second home. We come up there regularly. The Highlands, the islands, we just can't get enough of it, as well as obviously, you know, the places that are important to our family. So my partner being from Edinburgh and me, just outside Stirling. So it's a very important place in our lives.
This is a strange one because, I mean, my interest in land reform is very related to the fact that my mum came from Caithness, heavily cleared, and we went on summer holidays from Belfast to Caithness every year and got taken on the misery tour, basically. Everywhere any part of our family had been cleared from. And although they were not a political family at all, you know, they just accidentally were just politicising us with every single picnic. So that's sort of part of where my stuff came from. And then obviously kind of got involved with ASINT. One of my best friends was an ASINT crofter, then with Egg as a trustee. So, you know, it's kind of been part of my life, really, all of this. But how did you get so interested in land reform then with that background?
Well, essentially, I mean, we've also got a really interesting link with Egg. So me and my partner were on Egg 13 years ago now, visiting some friends who were working there for 6 months, and we spent a couple of weeks there. And in fact, that's where we met. While we were there, there were these lovely family, and they had these three boys, and the middle one was called Logan. And that's where we kind of got inspired for the name of our oldest son. And we've been back to Egg 3 or 4 times now. It's just, you know, and I think those kind of trips that really got me kind of tuned in to the debate. Obviously, you know, continental Europe, where I grew up, much of the land reform kind of action has been taken. They've had revolutions, they've kind of got rid of their nobility, you know, they've shifted into a mode of land ownership, which is very, very different to how it's kind of works on these isles, both north and south of the border. And so it was really in coming back as an adult and seeing really the reality of, you know, what land ownership really meant to the two people. And how it could be hugely destructive to whole communities. So it was really, coming back to Scotland as an adult, visiting, understanding from the communities themselves the challenges of being you know, of having land owned by a laird without the control and the power to do what they wanted with it. And then the huge impact that that can have when turning around. And so, you know, the buyout of the Isle of Egg has always been hugely inspirational. Also, kind of the writings of Alastair McIntosh were also hugely inspirational. The book Soil and Soul, you know, really changed, you know, the way I kind of thought and understood the issue of land. And, you know, I had the pleasure to meet, a few years ago. And, so people like that, yourself, the writings of Andy Whiteman, you know, understanding a bit about this deep history. And I think, you know, that's one of the other really interesting things. So obviously I'm based, you know, in London. And, you know, we're really also, as well as obviously being really interested in the land reform movement north of the border, we're really trying to understand how we foment a land reform movement, you know, south of the border. And I think just the thing you mentioned there around the clearances, it's a really interesting the way that that's, it feels so deeply embedded in the Scottish psyche in a really, really different way to, you know, the similar activity here, which were the enclosures. I mean, they were obviously very different in many ways as well, but it was about taking away land from communities and people and putting them to the use of their owners and the powerful. Mm-hmm. But those enclosures haven't marked us south of the border in the same way as the clearances still are talked about. And as you say, you can see them still on the in the landscape, you know.
And indeed, I mean, Tom Devine would make that point about, you know, the south of Scotland, that there was actually more people pro rata left through the lowland clearances, and yet the songs, the kind of, yep, you know, if you like, the mythology, the memory, the bitterness is not still there. But to move on to the report, I mean, one of the things about the report is it says quite emphatically that this is not actually on this occasion about righting historic wrongs. You know, that's not to say that there's not a real case for it, but just that that's not what motivates the report. So tell us, just before we start a wee bit, you know, where are you coming from? Which organisations have put it together?
Yep. Yeah, brilliant. So the report was commissioned. There's a really interesting route to the report coming about. So the report was commissioned by Revive, which is a coalition of organisations, including people like Commonweal, Friends of the Earth, League Against Cruel Sports, and they're seeking to reform grouse moors specifically.
We should just jump in and just remind people it's about 18% of the Scottish landmass is used as a driven grouse moor, which is freaking stunning. But anyway,
Yeah, exactly. It's not a niche activity that happens here and there on a few corners. It's taking up almost a fifth of the Scottish landmass. And they came together to ask, so myself and the organisation I work for, which is called the New Economics Foundation, which is a London-based think tank, together with Commonweal, to come about with a set of policy proposals that would really seek to kind of address the kind of the wider land system, acknowledging that really important steps have been taken, the community right to buy, the right to roam, you know, which were really important steps forward in kind of land reform. But now we need to get on to thinking, well, what are the next policy areas that we really need to be focusing? What are the next things, demands we need to be making of the next government in May? And how do we create a kind of consistency of demands for land reformers so that we can, you know, really get what we want? And as you rightly say, although historic injustices are not the main purpose in terms of what this report is addressing, it's impossible to not be shocked by figures such as the fact that 432 people own half of the private rural land in Scotland. And so those are things that do need to be addressed.
This is an interesting point, because what I find is, I've spoken at so many events on this, it is sort of shocking, and then it sort of isn't. You know, the more shocking thing is it isn't shocking to people. Because people don't go around with a comparative mind. You know, you do from Brussels, and maybe I've done by wandering around the Nordics. It takes you kind of being not in Britain to get an idea that this is not normal. And I was very impressed with the way that at the start of the report, you kind of take this on board and say one of the big things is trying to adjust people's minds to the idea that how they see land being used in Britain generally, but in Scotland in particular, is not normal.
Aye, can I just chip in on that? Because that's precisely the position. I mean, I know I've been educated more by Leslie over the years we've been doing the podcast. But I mean, that's the element I that struck me immediately when I read the report. And again, when both of you were talking initially at the beginning about actually being outsiders, having that ability to actually perceive things, those of us who are embedded within the common sense perception of who owns the land and even the look of the landscape, I've just got so used to, that appears to be natural.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's one of the tricks of the system in some ways, that the way that land is structured and owned has been really crafted and created over hundreds of years. And because change generally in kind of land ownership models and systems, you know, happens at a really glacial speed, people just assume that this is really the only way, and that actually the to and fro of the last 100 years have in fact kind of beaten this system into kind of perfect shape. And so we should just accept it as it is, you know, in the same way that many people talk about the, you know, the ecosystems and the landscapes of the Highlands and Scotland, but, you know, you could you equally talk about England as well as being natural, when in fact they're obviously, you know, far from natural. And in fact, these landscapes have been heavily managed, and they're really only like that because, again, people have created them. But absolutely, it's about hopefully giving people a sense that there are actually many other ways that we could manage this, you know, vital resource, which is land. And that many of those ways, in fact, lead to, you know, some of those things that we think of as really, really important. It makes it much, much easier to achieve. You know, if we do want a more equal society across not just wealth and income and things like that, well, actually, we do need to start tackling this thing called land. And it's very hard to get towards that more equal society. If we want to start tackling climate change, getting Scotland towards kind of net zero, well, we really need to think about how we use land, what land we put, what use we put land to, you know, if we're going to meet those challenges. And unfortunately, in the current structure of ownership and use of land, it's it makes it very, very difficult. And so, you know, that's why we're trying to, you know, really posit land reform, not as a looking back thing and addressing it, but as a, how do we achieve the 21st century Scotland that we really want to see?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on then to basically, how do you fix it? I mean, when you, this is the brave bit of this report, because lots of things have railed against the status quo. And probably most people who listen to this have got a fair versing of what's wrong with having this extraordinarily concentrated form of control. Let's just call it what it is. Mm-hmm. It's control. So diversifying control, you know, that would just seem to be a good thing per se. But then you see, you kind of keep stumbling into the lack of interest or will or confidence or what that politicians, principally SNP politicians, seem to have in this regard. So the other great thing about this report is that it says right up front, this glorious sentence that I mentioned in the foreword, that this can all be done with the existing powers of the Scottish Parliament. So take us through then. I mean, you start off with transparency, which is a bit sort of, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's really important, but it's a bit sort of, looks a bit kind of weak, you know, really, in kind of the great scheme of things. I mean, really? Transparency? I mean, if they own everything, does it matter whether we know who they are or not?
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting one. And you're absolutely right that it's probably not the most exciting, but sometimes those foundations, those things that you don't see, but are critical to our houses staying up and, you know, creating a good structure on top of it, you actually need to make sure that your foundations are correct. And actually, a foundation which is based on kind of opacity, of not knowing, of keeping things secret, that's part of how this kind of land system has been allowed to grow as such. So you're right. We do need, it's so important that we need that solid foundation. And so we need, I mean, it's, you know, in some ways it's still incredible that, you know, in the 21st century, we don't have a land register that you can query to find out who owns every piece of land. You know, it still remains incomplete. And then what's also crazy is that, you know, so much of the really useful information, so much of, you know, how to understand who benefits from land is then also not included in that. So for instance, we don't force the register to have beneficial owners. So at the moment we have legal owners, but that doesn't mean it could be a shell company, it could be a trust. We're not actually seeing who benefits.
So on that front, how does that change?
Well, all it would be a requirement in the and again, here there's also a kind of a Scottish Land Information Service, which is another thing that sits parallel to the register. And it could hold this additional information. And again, these are things that are already trialed. They're already being trialed and are already in existence in plenty of other countries.
Right. So why does it not work? I mean, why did politicians shy away from making it the beneficial owners? You know, the tax haven Johnny Chappies. Why did we shy away from getting right down to brass tacks?
Well, I think here's really where you get some of these really interesting aspects of kind of the inherent power in land, and about how this relatively small cohort of people who own huge tracts of land are also then entwined with the power and the politics. You know, we have to remember that, you know, when Parliament first started to expand those who could join beyond the nobility, and equally how we extended suffrage, so the right to vote, was initially based on property ownership. And so it was really, we were embedding in a system of democracy that really only the opinions of those who owned property mattered. And so you can very quickly see how if the only voters are the property owning and those making the law are all property owning, you very quickly see a dynamic of laws and structures in place that are going to be to the benefit of landowners. And so people at the high ends of wealth, you know, kind of value some of this privacy and also value. And this is where land has been one of the, you know, very effective tools at reducing your kind of tax bill, reducing your inheritance tax bill and kind of other areas. So it's kind of this, it's emerged.
But we're talking now about the I appreciate all of that, although yep. Quite clearly land ownership has been a requirement of every democracy, generally speaking, yep. To vote. So that it's just a question of what percentage of the population own land. You know, our problem is not so much, you know, the property ownership. It's the fact that hardly anybody owned anything. Because look, there's the Norwegians, where, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of people owned land, which immediately gave them such a wide electorate when they finally went for it in 1814. But we're not going down that rabbit hole. To come back to it, why are the SNP scared of making that tough call that we want a register that shows beneficial owners on it, like the original actual tax haven owners?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question, and it's one that I'm not sure that I know, you know, the detailed answer to. But all that I do know from talking about land reform to politicians like north and south of the border is that for many, there's a huge trepidation in, you know, huge fear of kind of getting into this area and legislating on it. Even the smallest changes to the land system are seen as kind of really radical and revolutionary. You know, just small things that we have campaigned on, for instance, to make council tax fairer, rather than being based on the value that a property had in 1991, it should probably all be updated so that we're actually paying a tax at least in some way related to the value of our property today. But even that kind of just revaluing of property is kind of beyond the pale, because ultimately we will see loads of winners and losers, you know, in that game. And so it just seems that to me that this is a system where our elected representatives are very reluctant to make important changes. And that's why, again, it falls on the members here to really make sure that people, that our politicians really understand that this is important to us.
Well, let's just move on to that, because we're moving into it. That talk of the council tax, we're moving to some of the policy detail on how we would manage to change things around. But one of your other big things is to reduce rent seeking. Now, that's not a phrase that trips off the tongue for many people, rent seeking. What is that category of thing?
Yes, so that's a term that economists love. And so I kind of apologize for the profession for like sneaking a bit of jargon into the report. But what rent seeking basically involves is an individual capturing value for which they either didn't do anything for, or they kind of capture a kind of disproportionate proportion of the value. And so land offers a really, you know, easy example about how you can think about rent seeking.
But how does that just sorry to be pernickety, how does that produce rent seeking? So basically they're hogging this asset. So nobody, and it's a monopoly asset. I mean, nobody else can get mere land. There's just that amount of land. So they're hogging the asset and they're making you pay through the teeth for coming anywhere near it.
Yeah, so there's two aspects. So what gets confusing with the land is because rent is obviously an established thing that you can do to land. You can rent land. And so what rent seeking is not talking about that, although there can be some rent seeking in the renting of land, which is slightly confusing. But it's mainly about something like if you just hold on to land, the land increases in value year on year. And in fact, so where we live, me and my partner live in London, in the last few years, like our house has earned more money than we have. The value of the house has increased more than the salary that I get paid by the New Economics Foundation. And so that is rent seeking because we are pulling value that's being created by the community because my property is not going up because of anything that I'm doing here. It's going up because we're investing in local services. We've got a really good local hospital. We've got three local schools that are really, really good. And so the value of my property is going up, but that value is all being captured by us through this house. And so that's really what land can do. It can go out there and capture value that's often created by the community. And a good example, even by government subsidies, for instance. So a good example is the Scottish government, again, with really good intentions, because we do need more tree cover in the country, started a subsidy for tree planting. So, and what that led to was a tripling in the price of land suitable for this type of forestry. And so here you have, again, public money being used to kind of inflate the price of an asset. Again, these people that were owning this land did nothing to triple the value of that asset.
Well, they did do something. They got rid of their tenants.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Importantly, you know, this was not a zero-sum game. This is like the Duke of Buccleuch.
Yes.
Who managed to, you know, so, and of course, very neatly done, just because they were all on short term, essentially leases. So he could just wait till the leases expired, didn't even have to get the E word in there, eviction. Just, you know, after 22 years of this, they just didn't have their leases renewed. And what was behind that was the ability to cash in on this kind of forestry grant from us, you know, Scottish taxpayers.
Yes. And obviously the Duke of Buccleuch has also just been in receipt of even more public money, thanks to obviously the recent buyout on his estate, which, again, it's hugely positive that communities are able to, you know, take ownership of this land. But it is deeply problematic that, you know, millions of pounds of public money is again being diverted, not to those in need, but to some of the richest people in the UK. And again, and if you look back at how the Duke of Buccleuch acquired the land that has now been acquired by the community, the Duke of Buccleuch certainly did not fork out a big six-figure sum for that land. And so it makes it really difficult to understand why exactly all of that public money should be going back to him.
Mm. Well, we'll come to this question of Beck's question of valuation in a wee minute. But so essentially, it seems to me reducing rent seeking is really unearned income through land ownership.
Yes, absolutely.
And so that might be a way to, you know, for those of us who walk down the rent avenue, since we've actually rented flats many a time, that kind of gets confusing. But OK, how do you sort of reduce the amount of unearned income that particularly large estates have through owning them without crushing the wee guy or girl.
Yes. So, I mean, here we talk about two particular areas that would really be ripe for reform. So one is the way that we tax land. And so we talk about in the report either looking at land value taxes, which are, again, one of these weird things that are very, very popular with economists left and right. But if you look around the world, very, very few examples of them being implemented successfully. And so we also looked at Commonweal had done some really excellent research looking at the application of a kind of flat rate property tax. And the idea here about implementing a tax is and what it does to rent seeking is that it prevent if while at the moment land is hardly taxed at all, if we were to properly tax it, it would extract some of that unearned income that the owner of land is getting and channel that to the public. So the idea here is a tax is a way of mitigating some of the rent seeking. So it does kind of reduce it, as well as obviously being a really great source of tax revenue, because the thing about the particular form of wealth that is land is obviously you cannot hide land. It's just there. And so, again, once you've got that proper register with a transparency of who owns it exactly, you then have a really effective means of kind of getting tax. So we talk about both of those. I think it's really, really important that we have it. But it's also really, really important that we think about some of the small farmers, some of the people who aren't kind of massive landowners kind of taking advantage of the system.
Okay, but before we move on to that, I mean, this is, you know, this is your normal, right? But this is kind of like, whoa, big stuff for everybody else's brain. So let's just go through this a wee bit slowly then. The flat rate property tax, I mean, you know, in a lot of people's heads, that would be like property. That's like my house. So you want a flat rate tax on the house.
That's exactly what I was thinking when I wrote down it. What I said that when I was reading through the report, Duncan, was flat rate property tax. What does that mean for me?
You know? So, I mean, so what Commonweal have done, which is really, really clever, is they've said, what is the total amount that today is captured by council tax, which is obviously what we're all paying on our residential properties. And what would happen if we spread that? So if we try to capture the same amount of money, but rather just capturing it from residential houses or from people's houses and the property around it, we looked at capturing it from all of land. So the purpose here is that the vast majority of people would see a small or significant reduction in their kind of property tax that they pay. And what we would do is shift much more of the burden of paying this amount of money. And again, council tax is really, really important source of revenue for the government and obviously for local authorities as well. What about if we spread that out much more broadly so that large estates, you know, with tens of thousands of acres are also contributing to the amount? So it's about spreading out the base of who is contributing, which will allow us to reduce it for both for those who own both small properties or quite low value properties by taking more from those who have huge land holdings. So,
It might need to just, I mean, again, these might just be words, but they might be quite important if you're selling this to the public in the same way as, honestly, I think rent seeking, just lose it, you know, but also, you know, it sounds like a flat rate property and land tax, Pat, eh?
That's exactly, yeah. It's property and land, because that's exactly what went through my head, was that it is that whole thing, because you do go on to explain in the report that there have to be mitigation and transitional put in place for, say, people who had low income living in high land value areas. So you have taken that into account. But I think you're on to a winner if it's explained in words that people can understand, like you've just done, Duncan, rather than terms like economic rent and rent seeking.
Aye, because the other thing is, you see, like property, you're assuming, and indeed it's true, that property includes land. But in a country where so few people own land, the bulk of people will not automatically think property is land. Because they have never, never, never even had the slightest sniff of that possibility. So no, I think you need to put it in with big capital letters there, plus land, folks.
But anyway. No, it's a very, very important point. And indeed, most people, when they consider themselves homeowners, they think that the valuable thing that they own is the home, when in fact, the home is in fact sitting there. Actually, the physical value of the bricks and mortar is depreciating, which means it's going down over time. The reason that your house price is increasing year on year, again, even if you do no upkeep or anything, is actually because the land under your house, or if you're in a block of flats, the portion of the land that's assigned, you know, to your flat, that's the bit that's increasing in value time and time again. So indeed, homeowners, why home ownership is so great, is not because owning a home is great. In fact, owning a home is just like a car. It wears down over time and depreciates. What is great in this economy about being a homeowner is in fact that you do own your, you know, a tiny parcel of land. And that is the valuable thing, not actually the house.
OK, so you can see that we're going through sort of essentially annotating in our pernickety, low-life, non-academic way, all the stuff that you've already written, which must be incredibly annoying. But that's us, you see. Now, the next thing would be, right, on this property and land tax, sorry, that's how it is now. There's then the problem, though, of valuation, isn't there? Is it a flat rate now? I suppose if it's a flat rate tax, are you just getting around it? How are you getting around it?
Yes, I mean, that's part of the challenge of a land value tax is how do you separate off this thing called land and this thing called a building? And, you know, and so some countries have developed methodologies to do it. And that's also part of why in the end, the report, you know, gives a slight preference for this flat land and property tax, because really, the combined land and property value is really just the price of it. And so, you know, and again, following a bit what the advice so far is, we're using kind of simple, already understood terms rather than having to kind of like, oh, to apply this tax, we need to get this land value separate from the house, which again, conceptually is a bit more difficult. So we're just saying the combined price today, what we call the market price of the land, that's what should be taxed. And again, so whereas council tax works by putting you in a certain bracket and then you're paying X, Y, or Z, with a top bracket having no limit. So if your house is 1 million or 100 million, you're going to pay the same kind of top bracket of council tax. The flat rate system ensures that the 0.5% is being paid at 1 million, but it's also being paid at 10 million and 100 million. So there is it becomes much more. It just becomes much, much fairer because those huge wealth are being forced to pay appropriately. But valuation shouldn't be a problem.
So watch out the Queen.
Well, the Queen, all of these large owners would absolutely see a very, very different, ecosystem. And part of the purpose of the tax is potentially also to trigger landowners to think, well, actually, if when it was made sense to own this land when there was no kind of annual cost to it because I could just about make it work. But part of the idea behind these taxes, as well as eliminating some of the rent seeking, is also to act as a catalyst to some of these landowners to release some of this land to the community, because actually you're changing the economics of holding that land, which is obviously so important.
Now, people will think, of course, when I mentioned the Queen, that story that had people absolutely gobsmacked that she was paying less in business rates than the local school around Balmoral, you know, that showcased just quite how broken the business rate system is.
Yeah.
But people will sort of think, but nonetheless, why is that not working? You know, why don't big landowners get caught by paying business rates?
Well, business rates is, again, it's a messy tax that's evolved over many years. Huge calls for reforming business rates. You know, even the Conservative government here is talking about, you know, changing business rates to, and again, even talking about things like making it look more like a land value tax. But it's basically a series of kind of exemptions and loopholes that have developed over the years as people have tried to kind of mitigate some of the worst impacts of the tax. Also, that it is the way it is. But like council tax, you know, business rates and they're both really, really, really desperately in need of reform. But
and so, to be clear, then this flat rate land and property tax would replace both the council tax and the business rate system.
Well, we talk about it absolutely, yes, as replacing both of those. But, you know, this is something that would need, you know, some really proper work by the government in order to figure out how best
for sure.
to
I mean,
implement
you,
it.
But you guys do a lot of donkey work, but you can't do it all. But just to get it clear there, you know, there's not, these things are not hanging on at the sides anymore. They're gone then. Right.
Exactly. And we need this much more simple tax infrastructure.
Sure.
Yes.
Another thing, though, that I mean, I know my own answer to this, but, you know, is the collapse then of the countryside. And this has been, you know, the kind of in the PhD I was doing that was looking so much at the period around the Second World War, with big decisions made then about many things and the interwar period, you know, where even the National Trust was set up to desperately try to protect the countryside from the collapse of sporting estates that followed the massive rise in death duties, in the belief that if sporting estates, these big sporting estates, did not dominate the countryside of Britain, the whole rural economy would fall to pieces. Now, we've maybe moved on a wee bit from that, but not totally. So, you know, this is what the landowner's card will be, is if you force us, because we end up paying more, and on you know, we're only just managing at the moment somehow, you know, if we're paying more for the land we've got, then that's it. All the gillies go, all the folk that are kind of working around the house go, all these jobs go, and you come back with what?
Well, I think here it's really good to point to some really great research that, again, I think was done by Commonweal, I think together with Revive. And what they did is they looked at land managed as grouse moors today, which, again, as we've said already, is almost a fifth of the country. And they looked at 10 kind of alternative uses, from kind of energy to kind of various crops to rewild, you know, to various other uses. And they found that all 10 of those potential alternative uses not only generated more local employment, but also generated more local economic activity. And so this idea that, again, which is understandable, because it is in the long arc of history that most people can remember, which is probably a couple of generations, it is how it has always been. But that absolutely doesn't mean that it's the only way it can be. And so important research like that, that looks at very concretely at the Scottish context, to show that in these kinds of estates, there are absolutely alternatives that do better on all the measures that landowners normally say. You know, it's about providing jobs for the community, about, you know, providing economic activity. But then also we must remember to look out and around, you know, and again here, you know, Leslie, your work in the Nordics and other countries, you know, provides us a tantalizing glimpse of, you know, what land ownership could look and feel like if only we change some of these kind of core conditions, these foundational conditions, you know, around which the system work. So that will absolutely be a big challenge for us. But we think actually now we can start to show that alternatives really do work, from both the Scottish context and by looking internationally at some of the best practice out there, which is obviously some of the great work that you've done.
Can I just nip in just for a second here, because that was a couple of things that occurred to me when we're talking about this, because I did see the analysis that Revive did previously, and it was again quoted in your research and in your colleagues' research, Duncan, is, yeah, you do create more and better jobs, and it's more economically viable to move away from the current patterns of land use. But how do you counter the narrative, which is, we're quite rightly, we're feared of losing our jobs, and how do you ensure, if it's been thought about, a just transition from one pattern of employment in these rural areas to another?
Well, Patrick, I think that's such an important concept that you have raised here, because just because we need to transition out an activity doesn't mean that we can just forget about the workers and about those at the sharp end of some of these transitions. And so you can think about the same way in which we need to, you know, our big green transition that we need to do. It's not okay to just throw fossil fuel workers and others to the side as we transition the economy. We absolutely need to, you know, bring and find opportunities for these. And so that will be a really, really important question that we need to address, Patrick, in the transition. Is how do we make sure that, yes, those who currently work in shooting estates, doing land management, can absolutely find opportunity as we transition out to this new world. And that's why, again, we must make sure, one, that much as, you know, many would like to kind of turbocharge this transition, and in many ways we do need to turbocharge it, at least in regard to like the very slow progress we've been making over the last kind of generations and centuries. A lot during the period of transition, we are going to have to put in place mechanisms that both help people train up, transition to new jobs and skills, and don't get kind of lost in the transition. So it's a really, really important point that you raised, Patrick.
Thanks.
Just to say that I have returned.
Yeah,
I don't know if you even noticed I'd gone, did you?
Well, there was a little thing that said 2 out of 3 in meeting, and I'm going, keep on talking, Duncan, keep on talking. I think we'll leave this bit in, just to show we're real.
Totally. Well, just to show this is, you know, yeah, I don't know if we can manage to weave something in about a dodgy rural blinking broadband, well, you know, and land reform.
That was it. Believe it or not, that's exactly what I was thinking, because, I mean, there was a couple of things you said as well, Duncan. The report said that working from home's fine if you have a home to work from in the country. And that was the other bit I was going to go into as well. But the just transition element, yeah, I think that's key to all these changes we'll want to make when we're going through this. But good broadband, aye.
Yeah.
Well, just to get back on the pony, so to speak, I don't know if we'd sort of got to, but presumably you explained your thinking on how the whole rural economy doesn't collapse just because, you know, landowners lose such a large part of the control of the land.
Yeah, it was really just to say that...
You have to recap. Just say, yes, I've said that. Move on, girl.
I have said that. There are so many other ways we could use this land. Yes.
See, that's the bit that I find I totally believe that. But part of the reason I believe that is because I've been around parts of the Arctic, you know, where there is nothing, there is minus nothing, and people are making better use of the land, you know, whether that, and it's seeing probably is believing in this context. And the difficulty for folk is what they keep seeing. See, like it was interesting at the very start, Duncan, that it was going to egg, you know, and seeing something actually happening that made you go, hang on a minute, this could be everywhere. Yep. And that's egg has done that to me, you know, so has Ascent in its way. So as every time you see people taking on the challenge of managing their local area, they make a better job of it, bar nobody. There are no exceptions to that. So you've got to have seen it working somewhere else to really believe this. But the bulk of people just keep seeing the empty moors, keep seeing the, you know, poisoned kind of blitzed landscapes and think, oh, God, look at that. Nothing would grow there.
Absolutely. And it's that power of the imagination. If you can't imagine anything beyond that and you think that that is the way it's always been, you're going to just accept it. Whereas if you've seen the potential, all you see when you drive through these, you know, barren open landscapes is a huge missed opportunity and a huge, you know, gap in what we could be doing with our land to make a huge contribution to something rather than just a bit of emptiness.
I still wonder how we get around that, because short of taking everybody to Norway, which would be a lovely thing to do, or everyone to Egg, which would be one big Kaylee, you know. It's really hard to let people sort of have this a speeded up version, because we haven't got enough time. I'm 61. It's taken me this long to get fully up to speed. And each, you know, all the time I'm even going, geez, I'd never even really thought of that. You know, I mean, we've talked before about the excellent programs that Prof Colin Stewart's done about the landscape and how even most of the trees we see around the place are to some degree planted, they're plantations, they're straight lines, big clue folks, nature doesn't do straight lines. So, you know, what we see around us as the natural landscape is so, so planted and developed, you know, but it takes a long time for all these pennies to drop. I mean, I just wonder how we can, I think we just need lots of pilot projects and artists could get involved. There was a great project that was part of a housing expo expedition exhibition outside Inverness, which I put in Blossom, where artists had visualized a new Highlands, and they'd painted and drawn a multi-use kind of vista right up from the shoreline with different kinds of farming going on within the sea, controversial, I know, but ecologically done, right up through the moorlands being used in different ways for energy and patched with all sorts of different crops that could be used and grown on places that are currently grouse moors. You know, it was, and some shooting going on. So it was a multitude of all of that, but it was graphically represented. And it was really striking. It was over a fireplace, a couple of fireplaces in houses where you'd normally have the monarch of the blinking glen. And instead, here you were having these tremendous vistas. I'd love to have 48 sheet billboards on the entrance to every town and city with these alternative, you know, think of an alternative Ulster, alternative Scotland, what it would look like to get your eye in for it right at the end.
I think, I mean, just to build on that, Leslie, so, you know, for the report, you know, hopefully when people see it, they'll see these beautiful illustrations that were produced. And so Common Wheel, in conjunction with the Duncan of Jordanston College of Art and Design, got individual students to kind of draw and visually represent some of the ideas that are being talked about in the report. And I think, you know, those kind of activities, those kind of collaborations are exactly what we need to see more of, as well as obviously more stuff on the ground. But, you know, bringing in the next generation, because, you know, I'm now in my mid 40s. We actually need to be, you know, having the next generation also coming up after me interested and hungry in these ideas. And so, you know, how we involve them is also really, really important. And absolutely, we need to change the way that we get people to imagine and think about the possibilities of this particular area.
Right. Now, we need to romp through extraordinarily large subjects incredibly quickly because we're nearing the end of our time, although we might have to come back to this sometime. Mm. Inheritance reform. Does that turn in people's heads to, so I don't get my mum's house?
Yes. I mean, it's also important to say that inheritance is the only area that we mention in the report that isn't actually in the powers of the Scottish Executive, so the Scottish Government. But yes, inheritance is a fascinating area in terms of how people conceptualize it, because inheritance tax and the rules around it actually impact, you know, a vanishingly small percentage of the population. But changing them is also one of the least popular taxes to change and to make, you know, raise more revenue or to impact more people. And I think it's partly this idea that, yes, is that everybody hopes that they will get a huge inheritance. And so nobody wants to kind of shoot that their own dream in the foot by also wanting kind of relatively large inheritance taxes or inheritance duties and things like that. So it remains a tax that affects a really small amount of people, but is also hugely unpopular with the general population. So it's one of those ones that's really hard to marry.
Mm. But let's move on to, right, well, yeah. Something that could, and this is a shocker, this one, is agricultural duties and so on reform. Yep. I mean, that this would have people's jaws on the ground, yep. This bit of your report, just alone, because...
Yeah, I mean, it's really shocking.
You up there, sorry. Boy, come on.
You put the cross in and Duncan didn't hit it. You delayed too long.
Terrible.
You'll never make the first team like that, Duncan. We'll try it again. So the total shocker is that whilst, and I'm giving you a wee bit more of a ball this time, whilst the English government have basically done something quite sort of adventurous and progressive, the Scottish government haven't they? Because
sadly, the Scottish government for the moment is just going to plough on with the idea of paying people a subsidy basically for how much land they own, which is kind of
just going to keep the old cap system is just going to grind on in Scotland, whereas the English have come in and said, no, 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 we only pay you for stuff we want now. So it's more public good oriented in England.
Yeah, I mean, this is the really shocking. Now, it has to be said that, you know, here down in England, you know, we're on a 5-year transition period. Nothing has changed to date. The government has been making loads of positive noise about public money for public goods, but haven't defined really in any way what that means, how it's going to be measured. So so for the moment, the English government's doing a good kind of PR exercise about talking it up, but not providing any detail. But it is in some ways shocking, as you rightly say, that the Scottish government isn't tacking along the same trajectory. We should not be, again, using large amounts of public money to merely reward people for the amount of land that they own.
And the point is that could be changed right now.
Absolutely. So this is something that should be on the agenda for change right now. We should be only paying public money for things that are public goods, you know, building hedgerows, you know, locking carbon in the soil. You know, these are the kind of things that provide a real service to Scotland and the community and the planet. And yet we're still on a place which just says, oh, how many hectares have you got? OK, well, I'll give you this much.
Right.
And this even applies shockingly to grouse moor owners. So many grouse moor owners, what they do is plonk a few sheep on the land. The sheep are there basically to mop up the ticks so the ticks don't attack the birds. And the CAP considers this an activity of farming and so pays out subsidies, therefore, to grouse moor owners because they're farmers. And I think few of us would think of grouse moor management as being a kind of type of farming, at least not in the way that, you know, public money should be going to. So we absolutely need to reform this totally.
I was just going to chip in there just to say for that CAP stands for is the Common Agricultural Policy,
yes,
which was the policy of the European Union, which we're intending to retain just now, rather than as the English government has mouthed off about changing.
Yeah.
But sorry, that was just a wee interjection.
Well,
because we've got so little time left, and just kind of move us on because we've got that. Yeah. That's just a mess. And also, you know, come on, folks, anyone listening to this, if you're involved in hustings, if you're involved in this election campaign, ask questions about this, because that's one of the reasons that this report is being put out now. It's in good time to be read, digested, and turned into a whole load of questions for every parliamentary candidate. But last big bit, perhaps, is to cap the amount of land holdings any one person or interest could hold.
Yeah, so here I think what we felt was really, really important that there needed to be other mechanisms, structural mechanisms that instigated the diversification and redistribution of land ownership. For the moment, for land to be redistributed, it requires the owner to take some kind of action, either putting it up for sale. There are very small cases in which the public authorities could kind of compulsory purchase land, but that's vanishingly rare. What that leads to is a system where land ownership actually diversifies and redistributes itself very, very, very slowly, because it's all at the instigator of the owners. And so we wanted to put on and lift up an idea that was part of the Land Reform Review Group recommendations, which was to create a maximum land holding, and that anything above that maximum would then be subject to sale, probably via the compulsory sales order process that the Scottish government is also implementing. Now, it's important to say that this cap is not let's take all 5.4 million people of Scotland, let's divide it by the total area, and that being the cap. The cap would actually be, and again, we don't go down in a specific kind of size of cap, but the cap would probably be in the order of, you know, thousands of acres. So it would be large, at least initially. But what that would do is kind of initiate the large landholdings and the large estates to really be split up and diversified. And importantly, again, when lots of people talk about kind of big transitions in land, you know, it's a big transition to in kind of state ownership of land. And again, that's not what this report is really interested in. This report is moving to a much more distributed ownership of land by us, by people, rather than by the state. So this is a really big idea, but ultimately we need, if we actually want land reform to happen, we need a structural lever that starts to push land out of these massive estates and these massive concentrations and into something that's much more diversified. And here we should absolutely be looking at, you know, some of the way that the Nordics manage their forests and other, you know, rural land assets, because they really point the way to how you get this kind of diversified. And we can also then, what's great about looking at those countries is you also then see the benefits of it as well. But this is definitely probably the most controversial of the
Indeed, because, you know, from one side of this argument, it is at long last the Mugabe land grab that every blinking piece of land reform, you know, legislation to date, which has made so little difference to the statistics, by the way, has been dubbed. Right. So we're finally getting to the Mugabe style land grab, accusations that the big landowners will have. And then on the other side, there will be people saying, why not just nationalise land?
So first of all, on the Mugabe side, so, you know, it's important to remember that this land would be transferred from one private owner to another private owner, ensuring that all of the human rights of that owner were met. So there's long established human rights law about how to under what conditions property can be a kind of move from one person to another. The Scottish government would not just be taking it off someone and handing it to someone else, as was obviously done in Zimbabwe, but for a fair valuation, and it would either go through the compulsory sales process, in which case it would be the land would be sold at auction to a buyer, and that would realise the kind of the value of that land for the landowner, or it could go through a compulsory sales process. So we're absolutely not confiscating land without any compensation for landowners, but we are absolutely changing the rules of the game so that large landholdings, you know, are by default considered, you know, undesirable. And it's important that we do also put a clause in which says that where a landowner owned over the threshold but was able to prove that both the local community, you know, fully supported them and they were providing tangible public benefits, that potentially they could hold on to that landholding, because we do want to acknowledge that in some places, for some localities, there are good landowners already doing good stuff. So just want to deflect that what we are trying to do is really analogous in any way to Mugabe.
But let's get the other end of this, because, you know, I've got to say, I can hear a slippery slope creeping in already there, because so many rural communities, and I live in one, will feel very, very, in fact, the reason that the land reform package from 2016 hasn't worked is because it put all the onus on local people to be braver than politicians.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, to have to come in and say, no, there's neglect. No, you're evicting people willy-nilly. No, you're not fulfilling. All of that stuff will get so many people thinking, if the landowner really wants to hang on to this and that prevailing mindset's there, that there's no other game in town, you just open that little kind of possibility even slightly, and so many communities will just find themselves horsing through because you haven't, you know, we haven't created a strong enough alternative. But can I just shunt you to the other end of that argument? Why not confiscate it? Why not nationalise it?
Well, nationalisation is definitely a possibility, but full-on confiscation is just very, very complicated if Scotland wants to remain a signatory to various human rights conventions and things like that. It would just open the Scottish government to massive and very, very expensive judicial proceedings, not wanting to get into obviously what's going on at the moment, but whether there is much appetite for huge amounts of public money being wasted on further legal proceedings, like, is hopefully hugely doubtful. So much as it would be in some ways a just comeuppance for some of these landowners who received this land for free, we must remember that in the gift of the king or whoever was in power at that time, we also have to remember that as Scotland being a modern country and signing up to various human rights conventions, that does also constrain us into what we can do around property. And so that's why, in fact, we do have to provide proper compensation when moving it. But we think it's actually money well spent, because the long term benefits will be just so great. And I've forgotten the second. I know there was a second bit of your question.
No, that's okay. It was slightly just the two ends of the wedge there. But I mean, you've still got a problem with this cap on landholdings proposal. It's so important. As to whether it's only applying to future changes, which means glacial progress, as you've outlined, or whether it's retrospective, which then hits the lawyers.
Yes, exactly. And so these are some of the decisions that, you know, need to be made.
Which one do you come down on?
Well, I've come down on being adventurous and having it apply from today. So and really defending ourselves, because what we really need to do is say that, you know, actually climate change is a make or break kind of issue for the world. And so if things like climate change, but also inequality, is being stretched really to where, you know, we're losing kind of social cohesion and really coming to its extreme. So and both of those massively important topics, I believe, could be argued as being justifications for the kind of policy that we're talking.
But you're talking about not retrospective then. You're saying from here on, if there's a sale and they never, and the land's never sold in the open market, or if there's an inheritance, which will happen, but, you know, over generations, is that really enough?
Well, maybe there's a difference in the nuance. No, so I'm saying in your definition there is that it would apply retrospectively. So it applies to owners today. It applies straight away, I think, is really needed. Right. Because otherwise, you're absolutely right, Leslie, in characterising this is another thing that, great, but means we really see change in many, many generations, possibly centuries.
OK, final thing, although it's not the final thing from the report, but just because we have to sort of draw it to a close. But I hope people are beginning to see how much discussing this narrow thing of land reform is actually touching on every blooming aspect of our politics. But, you know, reforming local democracy is a big one. And another total shocker is that currently rural planning only affects housing. You know, it doesn't actually extend beyond that to all land use.
Yeah, I mean, these are just two massive areas. So so planning again is about, I think a lot of people have a kind of bad impression of planning, but it's really about how we have some democratic say in how and what land is used to. And part of the problems with the planning process is this has kind of been captured by the interests that it's supposed to control. And so, you know, we kind of have two big ideas in planning here, which is one, that we should extend it into rural zones. We should have more democratic control over how land is used, and to make sure, again, that we can start to put land to the uses that we need in order to meet the big challenges. But we also need to make sure that planning is much more, or that planning decisions are much more representative of the community's interests and desires. And part of the reason why it's kind of co-opted by the big interests is that they're complex processes. It requires time to kind of put input to it. So the other thing we kind of talk about is how you get more kind of community involvement in planning, and even float the kind of quite novel idea of a kind of a jury service for planning. So just as we think that justice is a really, really important thing, and so we've created a system whereby we pay people to come and help with the judicial process, planning is also a really, really important part of what our communities look like, and again, how this land is used to meet the big challenges that Scotland faces in the 21st century. And we should absolutely also be ensuring that these decisions are properly democratically made and so on. So those are kind of our two big things around planning, is extended into rural communities, and also really ensure the participation of communities is meaningful in the planning process, rather than just being this co-opting of big business and kind of landed interests. Massive area, but really, really important. I mean, the other area that's really, really shocking is democracy. So if we want to decentralize and diffuse land ownership, It's really, really important that we've also got a local level of democracy that is at the right scale to help make that land ownership and use kind of positive, as well as obviously the local authority in many countries that have much more positive land ownership patterns than us being a key part of the land ownership model. In many of the Nordic countries, they own some of the forest, they might own the sawmill, that helps them produce local businesses locally, you know, things like that. But so we absolutely need additional tiers of local government. Scotland is one of the worst represented at a local level in terms of both the scale of the kind of the lowest local level and the size. And these are just not at a scale in which they can be really responsive to the local needs and the local communities and kind of the land. And so, and again, this perfectly illustrates your just last point, Leslie, is that, you know, really to reform land, you really need to look at the whole system in its entirety. And you cannot really, you know, make a new stab of land reform without thinking about planning and democracy as well.
James.
Yeah, well, there'll no demur from Riddick and Joyce on that one. I think the listeners have certainly heard us bang on about the reform of local government umpteen times.
Yes, with you and on actually, that we might well, it's making me think that a good next one might well be the Electoral Reform Society. Have got some plans, just like yourselves, you know, are working up some plans for how to get really stuck into the local democracy side of things. So maybe that comes next. Well, I mean, Pat, have you got a last,
It would have led us down a rabbit hole about how you stop landowners from gouging the public purse when they do sell off land. But that's something we can leave on the back burner there, because I think Duncan has been, I've thoroughly enjoyed this, genuinely thoroughly enjoyed it, Duncan. It's been absolutely superb. And if I've enjoyed it, I think other folk might as well.
Well, that's always useful. Now, Duncan, in case people are going, do you know, I think I could just about handle reading this report now, where will they find it?
So you'll be able to go to the Revive website and download it there. I think it'll be available from Wednesday, the 17th of March. And yeah, really do enjoy it. And yeah, hopefully it both looks beautiful and contains really interesting information. So it should be hopefully a good read.
And just for the teenagers, can you really spell out the website address?
Oh, I can. It's www.revive. Need to check it.
It got me.
Good. Yeah.
That's so embarrassing. I was doing so well with all the questions.
You thought you got away with it, McCann.
I know.
I think it's a .org, isn't it?
Is it .org or is it .org UK? And now my internet's being really slow.
So we'll leave it there.
Even
I mean,
in
everybody.
London, you see, I don't have good internet.
We'll put it on the notes at the end of this, and indeed, everybody can Google Revive, and Revive Coalition will hopefully bring it up. Well, can I just say what a stoating blooming start, the lad from Alloa. Alloa salutes you, Duncan. Thank you so much, Duncan McCann, for kicking off these podcast extras, and for really, gosh, apart from just having the URL of your Revive thing, having an answer for absolutely everything. I hope you'll take our wee attempted annotations of your technical language in good part. Obviously, absolutely. It's too late to do anything about it now. But but anyway, you know, this is a great package of thought to be pushing out now. And we have to get on with this. Never mind all the kind of ideas about wheast for India and all the rest of it. There's too much in this that has to be unpacked now. We just can't keep pushing this into the long grass. Yeah. So thank you very much for all of that. If anyone listening has enjoyed this, do let anybody else know that this is kind of one of the advantages you get from becoming a pal or a buddy of the podcast. And we'll see you next time, chums.